So today I'm here with Fred Wilson in New York City, and pretty interesting office space. I'm going to see if I can convince Fred to let me take a photo. It's a little bit like a kid's playroom in here, and it feels very creative. So just trying to give you a context. Fred, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for doing it.
So, Fred, maybe you can just start off and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I am a venture capitalist, which means I invest in startup companies. I've been doing that for 23 years now, and this is the third venture capital firm that I've worked with. I've started two, including this one. And we invest in web services companies. So that means that any business that is built from the ground up to exist on the web and pretty much only on the web is something that we would consider investing in. And in addition to that, I write a pretty well-read weblog called ABC. And I also am, I guess, a fan of new technologies and I'm constantly interested in what the next big thing is.
I'm an avid reader of your blog, so for anyone who's interested in it, it's abc.com. I was telling a friend about it last night, and actually, for me, it's the number one blog on the web. The insight and stuff that comes out of Fred's blog is not stuff that I find anywhere else, so good job on that, and that's kind of on here. I've been stalking you for quite a while now.
Thank you.
Maybe tell us a little about how you got your blog going.
Well, I've always felt that, particularly investing in web services, the best way to be a good investor in web services is to be an active user of web services and always trying to find and use the most novel and innovative new things that are getting launched on the web. It's a big part of what I try to do every day. And back in 2003, I had been hearing a lot about web blogging. It had been going on in some way, shape, or form for 3 years by then. And I was at an event that Nick Denton threw. Nick Denton is the owner and creator of Otter Media, which is a media company built on top of about 7 or 8 popular weblogs. And Nick had a party and had invited the founders of Six Apart, Mina and Ben Trott, to the party. And I was talking to Mina, and she told me that they were launching a hosted version of their movable type platform. So in the early days of blogging, there were platforms like Blogger and Movable Type and WordPress. And then they came out with hosted versions, which meant that you didn't even need to install any software. Blogger was the first web service that was really truly hosted. And then Six Apart launched Typepad, and so she convinced me to try blogging. And next day,
were you naturally a writer? I mean, have you been writing before then?
No.
And was it hard for you? I mean, you turn out a lot of writing out.
Yeah, I it's something that I just started doing. I hadn't been a writer for public consumption ever before.
But you knock out 200,000 words every single day. I mean, that's like...
Yeah.
Anyway, right?
I don't know.
I put you in a Hemingway. You write intelligent stuff, and that's not trivial.
Yeah. Well, that's what I found was possible. Writing on web is a little easier because it's instant. Right? You go, you write something, you get published, you're done.
Right.
There's no editor. There's no printing required, and you get instant feedback. So I just started doing it, and I decided that I would try to write every day.
You know, did you have like a day log with no feedback initially? Or did you have people posting?
I had people giving me comments pretty much right away. I mean, it'd be interesting to go back and look at the first 20 or 30 posts that I wrote. It was September and October of 2003. It would be interesting to look at that and see, you know, what kind of engagement I was getting. But I think I was getting 3, 5, 10 comments every post.
So you had traction right away. So you were already like a brand in New York City community, I guess. And so people were coming to
it. I think what it was that I was a venture capitalist. I mean, I think what it is I'm a venture capitalist, and what it always has been is I'm a venture capitalist. There's a lot of entrepreneurs out there who want to be successful raising money from venture capitalists, and being able to read the blog of somebody who's on the other side of the table, I think, has always been a great value proposition for the entrepreneur. So I think I was fortunate in that regard. There was a built-up native audience for what I was writing from day one. And then I think what happened is just, you know, I tell people, if you show up every day and there's a new post on the blog every single day, you will create a habitual readership who will come every day and see what the latest thing that you're writing about is. It doesn't take that long to read one blog post. You can do it in 30 seconds or a minute. So it's not a whole lot of time commitment for people. And then people build that habitual readership. And then if you just keep feeding it, then you've got something. I think also, my writing has gotten a lot better. So now I've written almost 5,000 posts.
Yeah, and each post is 400,000 words. So,
but I know what it takes to write a good post now, and I can bang one out in about 20 to 40 minutes.
Might be ready for a book. Yeah, give an editor on and turn the best post.
I have been offered book writing opportunities consistently for the past probably 3 years, and I always turn them down because what I tell them is that a book has an ending, and a blog doesn't, and I would not know how to end a book.
To read the book.
Exactly. It might be the book then.
Yeah. No, it's not. I mean, if you had a book of your best, see, here's what happens. I was telling my friend about your blog last night. He's never heard of you. Doesn't care about who Fred Wilson is. And I was like, I read the blog. And the blog, when you look at it, it's not very impressive. right? I mean, it's just, you know, a block with not that great of a layout. You know, all due respect, it's nice, but it's not that amazing. I was like, look, it's not something you see, like, right away. You have to, like, go through and read a lot of the stuff, and then you really get what's going on. As you say, you have 5,000 back posts. If you had the very best post turned into a book, I mean, I'd buy it.
Yeah, I understand that. And you know, I just have sort of a principle. I invest in web services, not publishing companies. So I kind of like to do my business on the web.
Fair enough. I'm interested in the New York City tech scene. You're a part of it. I went to an event last night, the tech meetup.
Yeah, it's a big deal now.
I went on Geekson Plane with Ben McClure,
right.
And so I was blown away in Tokyo where there was 200 people in a room for, you know, talking about tech stuff. I'm really, really impressed. I live down in San Domingo, and I've been telling people down there we need to get something started in San Domingo. So this thing last night, I'd expected, you know, 150 people, so there was, I think, probably 700 people.
I think they had more than 1,000 of those. It's
shy people. They weren't in New York.
Yeah. Oh, and not only that, but, you know, they broadcast the meetup now live over the internet. So we have a group of people that come here and hang out and watch it live in our conference room. And so we got another 10 or 12 people who are checking into those meetups here. And so there's probably another 20 or 30 groups like that that are doing it. So there may well have been 1,000 people who were engaged with that meetup last night live. It's a real happening. And I'd say when people come to New York and they say, I want to connect into the tech scene, the first thing I tell them to do is go to the tech meetup. Second thing I tell them is to join Next New York, which is a group of entrepreneurs and people who work in startup companies that have a much more regular meetup thing. They do sports, you know, they play dodgeball together, they play baseball together, softball together. So Next New York is kind of more of they do meetups too, and they have subgroups, but it's very active. And there's meetups now, there's lots of hackathons where people get together and hack Facebook apps or iPhone apps, Android apps, Twitter apps. There's meetups around different areas that people are interested in, cloud computing or hacking education, lots of different things that people are interested in here in New York, and there's a pretty vibrant community. It's not the same as what you have in San Francisco, because the startup culture, the startup community in San Francisco Bay Area, all the way down the peninsula, is probably 5 to 10 times the size of this community.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just the density of people who are working in startups in Bay Area and Silicon Valley is just...
It's different. I mean, I was talking with guys about it last night, because I live down in Silicon Valley, and I didn't find it very fun to live there.
Well, it's not fun
because everybody's into that, whereas here there's a part of the world is in that, but then there's like more people too, so just nerds.
I think there's a couple differences. One is Silicon Valley, the peninsula itself, is the suburbs. And in a suburban lifestyle, you're driving around in cars, it's kind of family-driven, and it's a little bit less... It's not as hyperactive as the urban lifestyle. So what we have here in New York is you've got fairly dense population, and people are bumping into each other on the street all the time. A little bit more going on in the coffee shops and restaurants and bars here than what you have in Silicon Valley, where it just permeates the entire culture. In Silicon Valley, you go to your kid's soccer game on the weekends, and there's going to be 3 VCs and 10 entrepreneurs on the sidelines cheering on the kids. Here in New York, that doesn't happen. I went to my son's soccer game yesterday afternoon. There was nobody at a soccer game that was in technology industry. On the other hand, there is this really vibrant culture. The place that I go to, coffee shop I go to, many mornings, there was 2 VCs and probably 10 entrepreneurs having breakfast there today. So it's a little different in the way that the communities work, but there's a really important and critical mass of entrepreneurs working in New York now.
So why do you stay here? And you're an ambitious guy. Why don't you move to Silicon Valley and do a bit?
Well, I've
been sacrificing by living in New York, do you?
I don't feel like I'm sacrificing. I don't feel like I'm sacrificing by living in New York. There's a couple things about that. I live here. My family's here. I've lived here for the past 26 years of my life, and I like it here. And I've been able to be part of 2, I think, pretty influential venture capital firms. We have backed many, many interesting companies on the web. And it's true that I haven't been able to invest in a bunch of great companies that have gotten built out in the Bay Area. But I don't really feel like that has cost me hugely. And all things being equal, I kind of prefer to do it the way I do it.
Well, my feeling is now that the influence you're getting with your blog and the investments you seem to be getting are all over the country now. And maybe it's even mattering less just because of the strength of the internet and then the brand that you're starting to build.
We can win deals in the Bay Area. My partner Albert and I were talking about a deal just now, right before we started this interview, that's based in the Bay Area. They have multiple term sheets, and the entrepreneur told us that they'd rather have us. So... Now, there are some great venture capital firms in the Bay Area, and we do get beat by them. So I'm not saying that we're the best venture capital firm in the country. That's not my point. My point is that we can be competitive anywhere in the country as a venture capital firm if we want to be. And I think some of that is due to the blog. Some of that is also due to the portfolio that we built. I think we have invested in a lot of really interesting companies. And when entrepreneurs look at that list of portfolio companies, I think they say, hey, these guys are smart. You know, they understand this business. They pick a lot of winners. I'd like to work with them.
Yeah.
And so we have that now, and I think that makes us a top-tier venture capital firm.
How does that help you do deals for your guys or support your guys? I mean, one example that I find interesting is like you're running Discuss.
Yes.
I've never
Discuss. Some people call it Discuss, and some people call it Discuss. Yeah. Daniel, who's the founder of the company, co-founder of the company, the CEO, says Discuss. So that's what I said.
So you run Discuss on your blog, which therefore all the comments on your blog start getting used to, and as soon as some new features there, like we see it, and so naturally I just started putting that onto my blogs, and it just kind of follows really easily, so you're all getting customers for the company without even really trying.
Discuss is a great example of a company that I think we can help and have helped possibly more than any other venture capital firm could. And because we have a focus on social media, because I have a high-profile blog, because I really understand the power of comments and I engage heavily in the comments, we can show thought leadership and lead by example with our support of that company. And so their support is more than just money. And when I was on the phone with Daniel last night for about 40 minutes, and we were talking through a couple of big strategic issues, and it was like he was talking to one of his top customers. They use the product. I'm a power user of the product. And it's also like he was talking to his product manager because we were talking about features and functions and should we do this first or should we do this first. And I just don't think that there are that many VCs who could do that for him, that company. So we are probably the ideal investor for that company. And that's one of the things we look for is what are the companies out there that we can help more than any other venture capital firm where we are the single best investor for that company. And when we find those, we try to invest in them because those become franchise investments. Someday, I think Discuss will sell for a lot of money. And then when people look at that and they'll say, those entrepreneurs did a great job. And the entrepreneurs should and will get, you know, the majority of the credit for that investment. But to the extent that any credit accrues to the venture firm, it'll accrue to us. And everybody will understand why we were, you know, very impactful for that business.
I'm curious, as you talk about these things related to entrepreneurship and being an investor, why aren't you an entrepreneur? I mean, you are obviously an entrepreneur, but why are you not building companies rather than funding them? Because you're always excited about the product development process and stuff that goes with it.
You know, I became a VC too early, I think. You know, I got out of business school and decided that I wanted to be a VC and went into venture capital. And I think that was a mistake. I think I could have been an entrepreneur, probably should have been an entrepreneur, and didn't know it. But now the entrepreneurship I do is starting venture capital firms. This is the second venture capital firm I started. And getting involved very early on with companies and supporting entrepreneurs, I feel like that, you know, I'm taking a fair amount of risk when we make our investments, taking financial risk, taking reputation risk, and I get a lot of the value that entrepreneurs get from doing that. So I feel like...
I mean taking reputation risk.
Well, if we invest in a company that blows up and you know, ends up being a really bad company, you know, I think people will blame us for being involved in that. So that's reputation risk.
Hmm. In a New York scene, when I was asking some guys about you and the firm last night, their eyes were like lighting up and they were talking about Fred Wilson. Like you're kind of an important guy, I guess, in the local community for them. And one of the comments that came up was the leadership and the things that you've driven here. And they wanted to know what do you think you should be doing more of and what should they be doing more of to help the local community?
We've got to create some big companies. The biggest problem we have in New York is there hasn't been a Google or a Facebook or a Netscape or Amazon or an eBay scale company to come out of New York. The closest is DoubleClick, which Google bought for $3 billion. And DoubleClick really is the app server for the internet. I really believe if you look at the internet, it's like an operating system. And an operating system ships with, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of features and functions in the operating system. The internet ships today with a bunch of stuff. The search function in the internet operating system is Google. And, you know, the auction function is eBay. And the payment function is PayPal. And the e-commerce function is Amazon. But the ad server function is DoubleClick. So, you know, we have had a company that scaled at internet scale and touches billions, you know, maybe not billions, but certainly hundreds of millions of users every day. And so that's great. But we haven't really built a consumer-facing internet brand here in New York of that kind of scale. And so that's what we have to figure out how to do. We have a few companies in our portfolio that have a chance of doing that. You know, we want to try to make that happen.
What do you think it doesn't happen in? What can you always think?
Some of it is time. I think the internet, the startup scene in New York really didn't get going until the late 90s. So we're maybe a dozen years into it now. And you know, go back to Silicon Valley, you know, which got started in the 60s, and, you know, by the early 80s, they had a few companies of that scale. Intel, you know, probably a couple of others. But, you know, Silicon Valley has really kind of hit its, you know, stride in the second and third decade, where they're knocking out, you know, three, four huge scale companies a decade. And so I think New York is now into its second decade as a startup culture, and I think, you know, this is a decade we've got to start doing it. And so that's part of it. And the second part of it, which is related, is that we don't have the We don't have the role models here. And role models can be companies or role models can be entrepreneurs. But it takes a belief in yourself and the thing you're working on that is that can withstand a lot of pressure to get a company that scale. Google could have been bought by Yahoo or somebody else. And if it weren't for the fact that nobody's willing to pay them enough money, it would have been. But they stayed independent and now have built a huge scale opportunity.
That's the story a lot of these, though, right? Like Facebook could have been bought and Twitter could have been bought.
I'm not sure Twitter could have been bought. I don't think that anybody inside the Twitter management team really ever had any interest in selling the company.
Not really.
But it is true that Yahoo had a handshake deal to buy Facebook for $1 billion, and they renegotiated it, and that gave Mark the opportunity to rethink whether or not he really wanted to do that, and he walked away. So, yes, Facebook could have been bought, Google could have been bought, and yet they weren't, and they went on to be these, 10, 20, 50, $100 billion companies, and now the world looks up to them as examples of what you can do as a technology entrepreneur. I think in New York we've been a little quick to, I'm not talking about Union Square Ventures necessarily, but we as a community of entrepreneurs and investors have been a little quick to take the first opportunity to get cashed out and not necessarily been patient and taken the 10 plus years that it takes to build an internet company.
Someone else last night made that point actually in a different way. He said that New York's more of a transactional city and Silicon Valley's more about building a big vision.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that is changing and will change. This is a culture that's dominated, partially by Wall Street, which is a highly transactional culture. And so I think that everybody likes getting a payday in this town. And it's an expensive place to live. Money matters. If you say, oh, I own, 20% of Twitter, which is worth $1 billion, nobody cares because they don't know why Twitter is worth $1 billion,
right.
Or even it is. I'm not suggesting that it is, but if you say, I manage a $1 billion hedge fund, whoa, that's amazing, So this is a different kind of community, but it's changing, and people starting to care a lot more about the entrepreneurs and the investors in technology companies here in New York. The reality is, our mayor is an entrepreneur.
Right.
Bloomberg is probably the greatest startup to come out of New York in the past 50 years. Mm-hmm. Nobody really thinks of it as that because he never took any outside investment, built it all himself. It's kind of a company that's very of Wall Street in a way that Google and Amazon and eBay aren't.
Hmm. That's an interesting comparison. One of the other comments I got last night was about Etsy, and that Etsy is a company it's a company that you funded. The founders have left, and it's a new team, and it seems like it's gone through some tough times. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you wouldn't say that Etsy's going through tough times if you were looking at their financials. So the thing that's amazing about Etsy is that from the day we invested over 3 years ago, every month the revenues go up and up and up, the profits go up and up, the number of sellers in the service goes up and up, the number of buyers in the service goes up and up. So if you were just looking at Etsy as a set of financial statements, the way maybe an analyst on Wall Street would look at it, you'd conclude that this is a fantastic investment, and it has been a fantastic investment. But it is also true that Etsy has gone from being founder-driven, highly creative, chaotic culture, to one that's run by seasoned experience management that is not necessarily quite as entrepreneurial as the founding team was. And part of that is growing up, and part of that is realizing that when you are running hundreds of millions of dollars a year through your marketplace and you have hundreds of thousands of sellers who are now earning some of their living, or maybe all of their living on your service, you have an obligation to keep the website up and to generate as much money for these people as you possibly can and all of those things. And so companies are like kids. There's the childhood years where everything's a possibility, and there's the ugly adolescence where, the child's trying to figure out who they are, and there's tension with the parents, and then they come out the back and they end up being great adults. And, Etsy, I think, has gone through the ugly adolescence, and I think it's now an adult, and it's a different person or company than it was as a child. Not as creative necessarily, but in many ways much better business.
Do you think, some of the big successful companies over a long period of time have almost needed to have their founders around, like Oracle with Larry Ellison, Microsoft with Bill Gates, and to me one of the most interesting ones is Apple with Steve Jobs. I mean, he went for a while.
Right.
He was having a tough time, he got replaced, and he's come back, and obviously that's a big success story. Do you think some companies have the personality of their founders need to be there to keep things running long term?
Oh, certainly much better. If the founders can find a way to stick around and continue to be either an active member of the management team, possibly the CEO, or if not, an executive chairman type role where they continue to be hugely influential in the company. That is Dave Morgan, who built Dakota, at some point turned Dakota over to Kurt Wiebrandt, but remained an executive chairman. Stephen Johnson, who started outside in, has stuck around as an executive chairman while Mark Josephson runs the company on a day-to-day basis. And in the case of Etsy, it would be great if the founder of Etsy, Rob Kalin, really wanted to do that, but he has two other startups he's working on now, and honestly, not every founder wants to stick around and be part of the management team when the job goes, you know, from creating the opportunity to kind of maximizing, optimizing, I guess is the right way to put it. And, you know, Rob's young. You know, he's in his late 20s, and he has so many great ideas that in some ways I would argue that, you know, the best thing for Rob is to move on and work on new stuff, because he has two new ideas. He started two companies right now, both of which are really big ideas. So, you know, for him, that's the right thing. And he's still on the board of SE, and I think he's still providing a constructive role there, but clearly not as active of a role as some of the other founders in our portfolio.
So the question that obviously a lot of people are going to have for you is how do you give their money? And I know that's not a simple thing, but that's the question you get asked a lot, so I should ask that on behalf of people listening.
Well, I think the best advice that I can give to people is build a relationship with me, get me excited about what you're doing before you ask me for money. Hmm. And that's hard for people because, you know, they need money. Right? So say to them, I want to get to know you, I want to be able to follow what you're doing, I want to watch how you're executing, I want to see you launch something, I want to see other people using what you launched, and then I'll give money. You know, that's a lot of hurdles that they've got to jump over just to get me to write a check. So a lot of people say, you know, no thanks, I want to go through a year or 2 year long dating experience. But, you know, a good example of this is Avner Ronin, who's the CEO, founder of Boxy. Avner came in here now 2 years ago with the idea to create a piece of hardware that would go in your media center in your living room that would connect your media center and your TV to the internet and provide services on that. And the software that ran inside the box was actually quite interesting to me, but I didn't want to be in the hardware business. So I said to him, you know, I don't really like this hardware business model, and, you know, there's probably some VCs out there who do, so maybe you should go talk to somebody else. But he stayed in touch, and about 9 months later, he came back to me and said that they decided to get rid of the hardware and be an open source software company. So that excited me, and I said, well, you haven't launched yet, so why don't you launch it? He launched it, came back to me about 3 months after that, and said, I've got 100,000 people who are using this. You know, I installed it, I started using it, and eventually, within the next 3 months, we were investors. So, you know, average of the time, he never got pissed off that I said no. There's nothing wrong getting pissed off. I mean, you know, every entrepreneur has every right to get pissed off when people don't want to invest in their vision. And frankly, you know, when we were raising our fund back in 2003 and 2004, you know, I used to take it personally when people would say no to us. And so I totally understand that. But, you know, to Adner's credit, he was very positive. You know, he managed to create a great relationship. He listened to some of the things I said that I think resonated with him, rejected many of the things I said that didn't, and built, a really good relationship to the point where when we invested, I felt really good about being partners with him. So to me, that's the best way to try to get us to invest money. But if you need the money in the next month and you come knocking on our door, it's highly unlikely that we're going to invest. This is not how we're wired in this firm. And so that's...
Do you get that a lot by coming through and trying to push for a deal right away?
Yeah, sure. A lot of people need it. You know, they run out of money and you know, they can't keep the doors open unless they can get more money.
Hmm. That must be stressful.
It is. It's stressful for everybody.
Actually, I mean, just to talk about Boxy, you know, I actually started watching the movie, the Swedish movie that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and I think I ran into the exact problem that you had with it. You made a post in your blog about how it can handle subtitles, and I thought it was pretty interesting what you said about we will be able to soon get movies from anywhere in the world and watch them anywhere in the world with subtitles. I think that's exactly right. I got the movie and started watching it with subtitles, and the subtitles were wrong. Is that what happened when you watched it?
Yeah, I had some problems with it. You know, so what Boxy is doing is Boxy is just software that runs either on your TV directly or on a device connected to your TV, and they're getting the movie either from your hard drive if you downloaded it or from the web streaming it, and at the very same time they're going out to an open subtitles database like opensubtitles.org and pulling in a subtitle and matching them up, and that's not perfect yet. And it will be perfect.
No, but I got it with subtitles, and so the subtitles I got, it's actually the first time it's ever happened. Subtitles were translated by someone that could only half speak English. So I was like watching all these people speaking, and it was like confusing as to who was speaking and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, maybe that's what Fred ran into.
Yeah.
So I then had to go out and find different subtitles for it, and then I'm like, okay, I'm speaking with something in accent. It was very, very funny to have that. Is that what happened to you?
It was a little bit different, but pretty much a similar experience. But what's powerful to me is not necessarily the experience that we're getting today in Boxy, but the idea that Boxy can connect all these various services that are out on the internet, whether it's Hulu or YouTube or Netflix or Amazon, opensubtitles.org, other kinds of things, and you create an integrated experience for people that is better than the one they have today.
No, I mean, I tried Boxy, and I've switched to Plex, and right now I really like Plex more. I've got it working with the proper remote and things that I couldn't do with Boxy.
Right.
I think overall it supports a lot of things better. However, the thing that Boxy did brilliantly was I could be watching a movie and then say, huh, these subtitles aren't very good. I want to go and watch it in Romanian, and it'll go out on the web and give me Romanian subtitles.
Yeah, I think the Plex user interface is better right now. And I think that if you have a Mac,
then that may be the best solution right now. But you know, Boxy is available on Unix, Mac, Windows. Soon will be available on Broadcom, NVIDIA, and Intel-based devices, which will include TV sets and possibly also a number of gaming consoles. So what Boxy is trying to do is be on every connected device, including the TVs themselves, and that's a lot of engineering that they're doing that is really hard work. They're also they've completely rebuilt the user interface, and the new version will be launching, I think, on November 19th, and it'll be interesting to see what you think then about Boxy versus Plex.
Yeah, I'll play with it. I mean, the open source community tends to be not very good at UI, so my hope is that Boxy can really get it together and like totally dominate.
Well, they hired a guy named Zach Klein, who was a founder of College Humor and kind of ran product at College Humor, and now is in a similar role at Boxy. And it just in the past month, Zach has really made a meaningful impact on the user experience. So I'm quite excited for when the new version of Boxy launches, because I think people will be quite delighted with what the company's going to put out.
I'll certainly play with it. It will be hard to get me to switch from Plex, honestly. I really am happy with Plex because it does all the stuff I need. The one problem with it is it's pre-alpha.
Right.
And it's just not quite stable. And that's the problem. So if Boxy can nail that down, then that would be a good thing. They got some work to do.
Yep.
Tell me, I'm interested from the perspective of being a VC. You have a finance background. How critical is it to have a strong finance background in a VC?
I don't think it's that important. You need somebody in your firm who has it, though. So I play that role in this firm. My partner Albert's pretty sophisticated financially, too. My founding partner, Brad, makes no bones about it. He's not a numbers guy. He's really a market and strategy kind of guy. So I don't think every VC needs to have that skill set, but I think at least one of the general partners in the firm needs to be a finance-oriented mind, so that the firm itself is always including the financial aspects of the transactions they're doing in the decision-making process. I don't think that the financial aspects of the decisions are necessarily as important as people in product or people product to market, but they're critical nonetheless, and they need to be part of the investment process.
You made a post the other day talking about how good VCs need to be well-connected and do a lot of introductions, and you had some concepts on how introductions should be done, and I'm actually rethinking how I do some things, because that was very, very, very interesting. What would you say the other key elements are for being a good VC?
Rolodex, I think, Rolodex and sales skills. So I think what you need to be able to do before anything else in the venture business is you need to be able to reach lots of people, reach the right people. You need to do that to source deals, and you need that to do that to win deals, and you need to do that once you've made the investment to help the company succeed. So to me, Rolodex is the most important thing. And then after that is salesmanship, the ability to convince an entrepreneur to take your money over someone else's money, and then also to help the entrepreneur convince people to join the company and to convince other people to invest in the company, to convince business partners to do business. So those are really the two most important skills.
Interesting, okay. Anything you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
I think we talked a little bit about interesting stuff.
Okay, I'll ask you one last one from the guys from last night, and it's the standard VC question. Any or what companies have you had the chance to invest in that you missed?
Well, I'll talk about a couple companies here in New York that we missed in hindsight we should have invested in. Two of the most exciting companies here in New York that we're not investors in are Huffington Post and Bill Group. Huffington Post, when it first got started, I thought it was a political blog, and it didn't make much sense to me why it made sense for us to be invested in a political blog. Well, what I missed was that they were really using politics as the market entry strategy, and what they were really trying to do was reinvent what a news service ought to be on the web. And I think they've done a better job than anybody else in really using the power of the web, everything from search, social media, user interface, commenting. They've just really done a great job there. And so now it's 20 million unique visitors a month, and probably the fastest growing news site on the web. That was a mistake. In hindsight, we didn't really imagine what that could be properly, and so we missed that one. The other one, Gill Group, is basically blow out sales on the internet. Essentially a U.S.-based knockoff, if you will, of the Bon Privé model, which is Bon Privé. Bon Privé is maybe the most successful internet company in Europe right now. It's based in Paris, and it means private sale. And Gill Group essentially is a U.S.-based version of Bon Privé. And I think what we missed there was the power of kind of blowout sales and how the internet could really, there's always been blowout sales, right? Lowman's or the Barney sale or whatever, and the stores will say, people love that. But I think the interesting idea that Bon Privé invented, that Gill Group and others have replicated, is using the internet and the power of the real-time internet to say, this is going to be available for the next hour, and if you want it, you got to come get it. And it's very powerful merchandising and marketing, and they've executed brilliantly, and it's a very big company now.
It came along, and you just say, like, it's not a strategic fit.
Yeah, you know, we're not great e-commerce investors, to be honest. It's not our long suit, and you know, the whole notion of retailing, low margin, high working capital business, the underlying financial fundamental dynamics, economics of that business is never been that interesting to us. And we let those biases against e-commerce cloud our view of what the yield group opportunity could be, and we're not an investment company, and you know, I regret that.
Cool.
Thank you.